evening I'll be reading from the New King James Version, Joshua chapter 21, 43 through 45. So the Lord gave to Israel all the land of which he had sworn to give to their fathers, and they took possession of it, and all dwelt in it. The Lord gave them rest all around, according to what he had sworn to their fathers. And not a man of all their enemies stood against them. The Lord delivered all their enemies into their hand. Not a word failed of any good thing which the Lord had spoken to the house of Israel. All came to pass.
Last words there, all came to pass. Fascinating. Fascinating. In our study this evening, we're going to continue to talk about the providence of God, the provisions of God to bring about His will. Not necessarily implying the exercise of miracles, certainly that's not the case, but we do see God working on every page. As we have studied in times gone by and discussed the general providence of God, it's not my purpose this evening to go back and rehearse all of that. If I can get this to work, there it comes. But simply to reiterate just a few things to get us into our study this evening. Let's see what's happened here. There we go. Juan, you'd be proud of me. I got it going. I didn't get it going. All right, let's try one more time. Evidently, I failed to turn that on. Plugged it in and everything. Anyway, in our study tonight, I want to talk about some specific areas in which we see the providence of God exercised. There it comes. Some specific areas. In our study last Lord's Day evening, we talked about the sin that man had committed following the giving of the command not to eat of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. We were basically studying through a period of Old Testament history. And we saw that God was selective in terms of the family that, or through whom Jesus would come, as he spoke unto Abraham. We're familiar with the three promises, the land promise, the nation promise, and the seed promise. And we note that as those began to be developed, it involves a great deal of history. God works in history. And I think perhaps one of the most powerful evidences of the existence of God, and certainly one of the most powerful evidences of the inspiration of God's Word, the Bible, is to look at God's working in history. When we note in our text of the book of Genesis, and we spend a great deal of time talking about the life of Joseph, and we noted that Joseph was hated by his brothers. What if he was liked? Joseph's father expressed favoritism toward him. He gave him a coat of many colors. What if he hadn't? Joseph's other sons were herding their sheep up in the land of Shechem. And when a caravan of traders came by, we know that they sold Joseph and he was carried to Egypt. What if they were going north? We talked about Potiphar's wife. What if Potiphar's wife had not made advances toward Joseph? What if Potiphar had not put him in jail? What if the butler had remembered Joseph right away? You see, all of these events, Joseph said when he finally identified himself to his brothers, "You meant it to me for evil, but God meant it for good to bring about this great deliverance this day." And beloved, we see God working in history. And I want us to be very much impressed with that. I want to pick up our study this evening as we go back to the book of Exodus. The book of Exodus. Keep in mind that God had said to Abraham that I'm going to make of you a great nation. When you read beginning in verse 5 of Exodus chapter 1. Verse 5 of Exodus chapter 1. It says, "And all the souls that came out of the loins of Jacob were 70 souls, and Joseph was in Egypt already. And Joseph died, and all his brethren, and all that generation. And the children of Israel were fruitful, and increased abundantly, and multiplied, and waxed exceeding mighty. and the land was filled with them. I want to make the observation in passing that here we have 70 souls that through the instruction of Joseph have been brought down to the land of Egypt where Joseph provides for them. By and by, we note that Moses was born and God eventually spoke to Moses and told him, I want you to go down, back down into the land of Egypt and lead these people up out of Egypt. Now you remember in Genesis chapter 15, when Abraham arrived in the land of Canaan, there were folks that were already living there, and I'm sure they weren't too eager to say, all right, we'll leave, and Abraham, you can have it. So Abraham asked God, how do I know that this is going to be my land? And you recall what God told him? He said, 4 generations are going to come and go. 400 years will pass. And your descendants will come again into this land. And they will come with a great deliverance, and they will come with great substance. Now the events transpiring from the time that God spoke to Abraham till the time that we're beginning to read about here in the early chapters of the book of Genesis, a lot of history has occurred. And do we not see, in the words of Joseph, God making provision for these people to bring them down into the land of Egypt? And when Moses goes down to bring them up, God has told Moses, this is what I want you to do, but in verse 21 of chapter 4, it tells us, and Jehovah said unto Moses, when thou goest back into Egypt, see that thou do before Pharaoh all the wonders which I put in thy hand, but I will harden his heart, and he will not let the people go. Won't do it. Now that's of interest to me. Because God is telling Moses to do something that he knows Pharaoh is not going to immediately do. And God said to Moses, I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will not let you go. Now in chapter 5, when you look at verses 1 and 2, Moses and Aaron appear before Pharaoh and tell Pharaoh, let the people go 3 days into the wilderness that they may hold a feast. And Pharaoh said, who is Jehovah that I should hearken unto his voice to let Israel go? I know not Jehovah, and moreover, I will not let Israel go. Oh, yes, you will. Because God is going to see to that. Now note, if you will, God had told Moses, I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will not let the people go. This is the beginning now of the plagues that God brought upon the nation of Egypt. And as you look in the ninth chapter, in verse 12 it says, and Jehovah hardened the heart of Pharaoh, and he hearkened not unto them, as Jehovah has spoken unto Moses. Now, the thing that's interesting to me about that is we find Pharaoh reacting just exactly like God said that he would. Now, we might raise the question and say, well, how did God know that? Well, that don't take a whole lot of searching. He's God. But as we go just a little bit deeper into that question, how did God know that Pharaoh would not be receptive to the request of Moses and Aaron? Well, God said, I will harden his heart. Now the thing that has posed a question through the years, many have asked it, when you look at chapter 4 in verse 21, God said, I'm going to harden his heart. When you look at chapter 7, verse 3, it tells us that God hardened Pharaoh's heart. In chapter 9, verse 12, again we learn that God hardened Pharaoh's heart. In chapter 10, verse 1, it tells us that God hardened Pharaoh's heart, verse 20, and also in verse 27. And in chapter 14, verse 4, God hardened Pharaoh's heart. Did so multiple times, the text tells us. But then as you go back just a little bit to the 8th chapter and look in verse 15. Chapter 8, verse 15. It says, but when Pharaoh saw that there was respite, he hardened his heart and hearkened not unto them as Jehovah had spoken. Who hardened his heart? Pharaoh did. You'll see that repeated in chapter 8, verse 32. Chapter 9, verse 34. And in chapter 10, But my point is, numerous times the text tells us that God hardened Pharaoh's heart. But yet we also know that numerous times Pharaoh hardened his own heart. How do we reconcile that in history? God said, I will harden Pharaoh's heart. And indeed he did. How did he do that? I like to use the illustration. If you tell a little one sometimes to clean up their room, and they don't do that, you get a little bit more insistent when you say the second time, I want you to clean up your room. And what do? They dig their heels in just a little bit deeper, don't they? Now, could it be said that the child hardened their heart? Didn't want to do what you said. That's right. Could it be said that the parent hardened the child's heart? Yes, could be said that. Well, why? How do we reconcile it? Very simply, in this text, God asked Pharaoh to do something that he just didn't want to do. And the more that God insisted, the harder Pharaoh became. So God hardened Pharaoh's heart. But Pharaoh hardened his own heart. Now you remember what God said to Abraham? Way back in Genesis chapter 15, 400 years will pass and he'll let you go and they'll come out with great substance. Now turn, if you will, to Exodus chapter 14. In Exodus chapter 14. No, Exodus chapter 12. I'm sorry. Don't want 14 just yet. In Exodus chapter 12, we read about the Passover feast, how that it was instituted, so that when the death of the firstborn was to come upon those of the household of the Egyptians, those of the Israelites who had the blood, as you know, sprinkled on the doorpost and the part over the door, death would not come to their house. And we note then, beginning in the latter portion of the 12th chapter, if you'll pick up the reading at verse 29, it says, it came to pass at midnight that Jehovah smote all the firstborn of the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh that sat on his throne, to the firstborn of the captive that was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of cattle. And Pharaoh rose up in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where there was not one dead. And he called for Moses and Aaron by night and said, rise up, get you forth from among my people, both ye and the children of Israel, and go serve Jehovah as ye have said. Take both your flocks and your herds as ye have said, and be gone, bless me also. And the Egyptians were urgent upon the people and sent them out of the land in haste, for they said, we are all dead men. And the people took their dough before it was leavened, their kneading troughs being bound up in their clothes upon their shoulders. And the children of Israel did according to the word of Moses. And they asked of the Egyptians jewels of silver and jewels of gold and raiment. And Jehovah gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians so that they let them have what they asked. And they despoiled the Egyptians. You go back to Genesis 15, beginning in verse 12, that's exactly what God said would occur. 400 years down the pipe. That's what's going to happen. Pharaoh's going to let them go. Now, we noted in the beginning of the book of Exodus that there were 70 that were brought down into the land. And we note here that the Egyptians thrust them out with great haste. And we want to ask the question, just how many of them were there? Look, if you would please, in verse 37. And the children of Israel journeyed from Ramesses to Succoth, about 600,000 on foot that were men besides children. If you turn over just a little further to Exodus chapter 38 and verse 26, we learn that there were 603,550. So we see this number here rounded off. That's the fighting men. Scholars tell us when you factor in the women and the children and the old folks and so forth, that we come up with a number somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 to 3 million people. You remember what God said to Abraham? I'm going to make of you a great nation. He made of Abraham a great nation as he brought these people up out of the land of Egypt. When the promise was made, he had not a son. But now he has a multitude of descendants, just as God has said, as the stars of the heaven and as the sand of the seashore. Does that impress you that God was able to bring that about just exactly as he promised? Now when you come to the 14th chapter, God had told these people that the Egyptians, they're going to be destroyed. And in verse 13, when they stand before the Red Sea and the Egyptians behind them, it tells us in verse 13, "And Moses said unto the people, Fear ye not, stand still and see the salvation of Jehovah, which he will work for you today, for the Egyptians whom ye have seen today, ye shall see them again no more forever. Jehovah will fight for you, and ye shall hold your peace." And we know that the people came across the Red Sea on dry ground, and the Egyptians were destroyed. Now that brings us to the Exodus of the people of Israel out of bondage. Turn the page, if you will, over to Exodus chapter 19. Exodus chapter 19. We know that they have come across the Red Sea and they're sojourning in the wilderness of Sinai. And about 3 months or so out from Egypt, it tells us, beginning in verse 4, "Ye have seen what I did unto the Egyptians, and how I bare you on eagle's wings and brought you unto myself. Now therefore, if you will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then ye shall be mine own possession from among all people. For all the earth is mine, and ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." What did God say to Abraham way back there? "I'm going to make of you a great nation." Now we have 2 to 3 million people coming up out of the land of Egypt with all the wealth of Egypt, just as they had been told. Just as Abraham had been told way back in Genesis chapter 15. And here we find that God himself calls these people a great or a holy nation. Does that impress you? God did that. He brought that to pass, just as he promised that he would. Now you remember that back in Genesis 15, God told Abraham the perimeters of the land, the borders of the land that he was going to give unto him. Turn back to Genesis 15 and look beginning in verse 18. It says, "In that day Jehovah made a covenant with Abram, saying, Unto thy seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenite, the Kenizzite, and the Kadmonite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Rephaim, and the Amorite, and the Canaanite, and the Girgashite, and the Jebusites." A lot of ites. But God identifies the people that were then living in the land and says, "That land's going to one day belong to those who have descended from you." Now, the book of Joshua begins. We know that Moses is not allowed to enter into the promised land as he and Aaron have committed sin. But Joshua becomes the new military leader to lead them into the land that God had promised. And in Joshua chapter 6, I've got to make this point. In Joshua chapter 6, you'll note that the city of Jericho was the first of the cities of conquest of the land. And you're well familiar with how they took the city of Jericho. But an interesting observation you will note in verse 26 of Joshua chapter 6. Joshua charged them with an oath at that time, saying, "Cursed be the man before Jehovah that riseth up and buildeth this city Jericho with the loss of his firstborn, shall he lay the foundation thereof, and with the loss of his youngest son shall he set up the gates of it." So Jehovah was with Joshua, and his fame was in all the land. We don't have the time to discuss that in great detail, but I want you to read another passage in connection with it. In 1 Kings chapter 16, in 1 Kings chapter 16, while you're there, if you would please, look at verse 34. Verse 34. Now, a lot of things have occurred from the time of Joshua conquering the city of Jericho and to the period that we're reading about in the Kings. In this portion, in the Kings, we're reading about the time of Ahab. You remember old Ahab and wicked Jezebel? But in verse 34, it tells us, "In his days," that is, in the days of Ahab, "In his days did Hiel the Bethlehemite build Jericho. He laid the foundation thereof with the loss of Abraham, his first son, or firstborn, and set up the gates thereof with the loss of his youngest son, Segeb, according to the word of Jehovah, which he spake by Joshua, the son of Nun." Now that's all you know about that, is what you read in these two verses. But why is that little tidbit of information here? to show us what God can do, to show us the working of God. Joshua said, this is how it's going to be. And Jenny, I'll let you do the figuring of the calculations, you or John, and figure how long it was from the days of the conquering of the city of Jericho till the time that this man attempted to rebuild it. And we might raise the question, how did Joshua know that? And how did it come to pass? Just exactly like God said. Did God make this man do that? No, his will worked independent. But God used this man to demonstrate his great power. Now, I said all that to say this. Go back to the book of Joshua. In Joshua chapter 11, in verse 23, it says, so Joshua took the whole land according to all that Jehovah spake unto Moses, and Joshua gave it for an inheritance unto Israel according to their divisions by their tribes, and the land had rest from war. Who gave them the land? God did. He gave them the land. Joshua led as the military leader in the conquering of the land, but if you'll turn the pages all the way over to the text that was read just a few moments ago, in verse 43 of chapter 21, so Jehovah gave unto Israel all the land. What land did he give them? It tells us which he swore to give unto their fathers, and they possessed it and dwelt therein, and Jehovah gave them rest round about. All came to pass, verse 45, not one thing failed. Now, do you see in the working of all of this history, God bringing to pass just exactly what He had promised that He would do? Now, He didn't do that independent of man's will. It was not miraculous. But what we do see is God fulfilling the promise that He made unto Abraham to make of them a great nation, to give unto them a particular land. And we see that that promise was indeed fulfilled. Now, if you'll turn the page over to Joshua chapter 23, it tells us, beginning in verse 14, and behold, this day I am going the way of all the earth. And ye know in all your hearts and all your souls that not one thing hath failed of all the good things which Jehovah your God spake concerning you. All are come to pass unto you, not one thing hath failed. And it shall come to pass that as all the good things are come upon you of which Jehovah your God spake unto you, so will Jehovah bring upon you all the evil things until he have destroyed you from off this good land which Jehovah your God hath given you. When ye transgress the covenant of Jehovah your God which he commanded you, and go and serve other gods and bow down yourselves to them, then will the anger of Jehovah be kindled against you, and ye shall perish quickly from off the good land which he hath given unto you. Now, we've read that many times in our history and geography study, but what I want you to remember here is who did that? Who gave them the land? God did. Now, when they began to worship and serve idols, what's God going to do to them? He said, I am going to destroy you from off this good land. Now, sometimes backtracking is helpful just a bit. Turn back, if you will, to Deuteronomy chapter 4. Deuteronomy chapter 4. Now, we're going back on the timeline now, before the time of Joshua, to the time of Moses, when Moses led these people up out of the land of Egypt. And in Deuteronomy, that's Exodus, in Deuteronomy chapter 4, look at verse 25. Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 25. It says, and thou shalt beget children and children's children, and ye shall have been long in the land, and shall corrupt yourselves and make a graven image in the form of anything that shall, or and shall do that which is evil in the sight of Jehovah thy God to provoke him to anger. I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day that ye shall perish, or ye shall soon utterly perish from off the land whereunto ye go over the Jordan to possess it. Ye shall not prolong your days upon it, but ye shall be utterly destroyed. Who's going to do that to them? God is. How did Moses know that? You see, we're talking about something that's going to occur several years down the pike. And we say, well, Moses was a prophet. I know that. But who was going to do it, brethren? God would. God was going to destroy them from off this good land. Now, not only did Moses know that it would happen, but he understood that God would do it. Now, he didn't understand the how that God would do it, but we are told. As we read further in our Bible, we come to the period of the judges. Past Joshua now, to the period of the judges. And we note in the period of the judges, a period that took about 300, 305 years to pass, when Joshua and all his generation passed, we know in verse 10 it says, "And also all that generation were gathered unto their fathers, and there arose another generation after them that knew not Jehovah, nor yet the work which he had wrought for Israel." And then time and time and time again, I've done this with you before, and I think it's impressive, how many times they began to worship idols, and how many times God raised up an enemy against them to punish them for their practice of idolatry. For example, in verse 11, the children of Israel did that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah and served Balaam. In chapter 3, verse 7, the children of Israel did that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah and forgot Jehovah their God and served the Balaam and the Asherah. What do we learn in this? Just time after time after time, the whole book of Judges, the people are worshiping and serving idols, and when they repent, God raises up a deliverer known as a judge who would deliver them from the hand of their oppressors. Isn't that just exactly what God told them would happen? You worship and serve idols, and I'm going to take some of your land until I've destroyed you utterly from off the land. Now, when you come to the end of the book of Judges, the very last verse, it says, "In those days there was no king in Israel, and every man did that which was right in his own eyes." Now, we would describe that, everybody just doing as he pleased. And that's right. That's just exactly what took place. Everybody's just doing as they please. Now, what did God say was going to happen to them when they did that? "I'm going to destroy you." Now, when we look at the next period of history, it's called the period of the United Kingdom, because we find that God is ruling His people now over by means of a king, because they have asked for a king. Well, let's turn back again to the book of Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy chapter 17, reading beginning in verse 14, Moses said, "When thou art come into the land which Jehovah thy God giveth thee, and shall possess it, and shalt dwell therein, and shalt say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are round about me, thou shalt surely set him king over thee whom Jehovah thy God shall choose. One from among thy brethren shalt thou set king over thee. Thou mayest not put a foreigner over thee who is not thy brother, only he shall not multiply horses to himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt, to the end that he may multiply horses. For as much as Jehovah has said unto you, ye shall henceforth return no more that way, neither shall he multiply wives to himself, that his heart turn not away, neither shall he greatly multiply to himself silver and gold." Well, that's going to be very important to us down the pike, but it is already, because we see in 1 Samuel chapter 8 that the people come unto God, or come unto Moses. They come unto Samuel, I get that right, they come unto Samuel and they say, "We want to have a king so that we can be like all the nations round about us." That's just exactly what Moses said that they would request. And he described then the kind of king that should be selected. Well, God selected Saul to be the first of their kings, and we know that Saul started out to be a very humble man, desiring to do the will of God. But when we come to 1 Samuel chapter 13, Saul was lifted up with arrogancy. And Samuel told him to go wait in Gilgal, and I'll come and we'll offer the sacrifice. Or I will. I'll offer the sacrifice before you go to fight against the Philistines. And when Samuel arrived, it had already been offered by Saul. And Saul said, "I forced myself." I find that interesting. "I forced myself to do that." In 1 Samuel chapter 15, God told him to smite Amalek and utterly destroy all the Amalekites. And he didn't do that. He brought back the best of the Amalekites. And Saul was told by Samuel, "You didn't do what God said. And because you didn't do what God said, God is going to cause you to cease from being king. Your kingdom will be taken from you." Now, an interesting note just there. His kingdom could have been established, and by that we simply mean that his successors could have been king on his throne. But because of what Saul did, none of his successors ever became king. But David was the next king to be appointed. It's 1 Samuel chapter 13 and in verse 14. Many historical lessons to discuss where David is concerned. But one passage I want you to remember is 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 14 through verse 16. Specifically, in the latter part of that reading, we know that God told David through the prophet Nathan that I will establish thy throne forever. That's interesting, isn't it? I will establish it forever. Now, when we read of the establishment of someone's throne, again, let us keep in mind that we're talking about succession of kings to sit upon the throne that descended from that individual. And what's prophesied here, and we know it's so as we look in Acts chapter 2, is that Nathan is telling David about the coming of Jesus and how that Jesus, his descendant through the tribe of Judah, would be set upon the throne at the right hand of God and rule. Now, beloved, as we think about that for just a little bit, we see that there were a lot of history transpired from the time of David to the coming of Jesus. But yet the very thing that God promised was preserved, and it came to pass just as God had said, and you can read it in Acts chapter 2. And again, you can do the math on that and figure out how long it was from the time of David to the time of the coming of Jesus. About 1,000 years, just to give you a round figure. Then Solomon became king. David's son, a lot of things in the life of Solomon. Not our purpose this evening to talk about everything that Solomon did, but we know that Solomon had a certain degree of wisdom because God asked him, if there's something I can do for you, you tell me. Make a wish, so to speak. And Solomon said that I am but a little child, chapter 3. Verse 5, I know not how to go out or come in. In verse 9, he said, give thy servant therefore an understanding heart to judge thy people, that I may discern between good and evil, for who is able to judge this thy great people? And we know the blessings that God bestowed upon him because of his request. And we see numerous manifestations of this great degree of Solomon, a great degree of wisdom of Solomon. But when we come to the 11th chapter, we might note in the 11th chapter that Solomon loved many foreign women. Verse 1, together with the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites and Ammonites and Edomites and Sidonians and Hittites, of the nations concerning which Jehovah has said unto the children of Israel, you shall not go among them, neither shall they come among you. And in verse 4, it tells us, for it came to pass when Solomon was old that his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not perfect with God with Jehovah his God, as was the heart of David his father. And in verse 5 and 6 we see the extent to which he began to worship idols. Now in the 11th chapter, if you'll drop down to verse 11, God said, therefore Jehovah said unto Solomon, for as much as this is done of thee, thou hast not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded thee, I will surely rend the kingdom from thee and will give it unto thy servant. Notwithstanding in thy days, I will not do it for David thy father's sake, but I will rend it out of the hand of thy son. Howbeit, I will not rend away all the kingdom, but I will give one tribe to thy son for David my servant's sake and for Jerusalem's sake, which I have chosen. Now that becomes a profound passage. Why? Well, Solomon's done the very thing God said not to do. And God said, I'm going to take the kingdom from you. But I'm not going to do it in your lifetime. I'm going to do it in the lifetime of your son. What was it that Moses told them would happen when they began to worship idols? Moses told them, kingdom going to be taken from you. You'll lose the land. God will destroy you. And we notice here that Solomon has done that very thing. And God said, I'm going to take the kingdom from you. And I'm going to do that in the days of your son, Rehoboam. Well, when you come to chapter 12, we read of the foolishness of Rehoboam. The kingdom was divided, as you well remember. All in keeping with what God said, I will do. I want you to underscore that. God working in history. God said, I will do this. And we have to turn to the history to see how God said, or how that God did that. The point I want us to look at just here is that idolatry is now introduced into the northern kingdom. As Jeroboam comes back from Egypt and becomes the king of the first king of the northern 10 tribes, and Jeroboam brought back with him the practice of calf worship. Calf worship. And you recall that one of the first things that he did in chapter 12, he said, it's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. So he built an idol in Bethel and one in Dan, a golden calf, and told these people, you go there and worship because it's just too much for you to go to Jerusalem. And we see then the introduction of calf worship among these people. As you turn to the 14th chapter and look at verse 7. Chapter 14, verse 7. God said to the prophet, go tell Jeroboam, thus saith Jehovah the God of Israel, for as much as I exalted thee from among the people, and made thee prince over my people, and rent the kingdom away from the house of David, and gave it to thee, and yet thou hast not been as my servant David, who kept my commandments, and who followed me with all his heart, to do that only which was right in mine eyes, but hast done evil above all that were before thee, and hast gone and made thee other gods, and molten images to provoke me to anger, and hast cast me behind thy back. Therefore, behold, I will bring evil upon the house of Jeroboam, and will cut off from Jeroboam every man child. In other words, Jeroboam, your lineage is going to be cut off. Who's going to do that? God said, I will. I'm going to do that. Now, we're not told here the history of how God did that, but we just keep turning the pages. And do we not see God involved in the development of this history throughout Old Testament history? But yet he didn't overrule the choices that men made. He didn't run over their will. He used their wills to accomplish his purposes. In 1 Kings chapter 16, 1 Kings chapter 16, in verse 2, we read about Baasha, who was king over the northern kingdom, the kingdom of Israel. And in verse 2, God said, for as much as I exalted thee out of the dust and made thee prince over my people Israel, and thou hast walked in the way of Jeroboam and hast made my people Israel to sin, to provoke me to anger with their sins, behold, I will utterly sweep away Baasha and his house, and I will make thy house like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. Now we know that Jeroboam died, and we know that old Baasha died. Zimri killed him. And if you'll note in verse 11, it says, and it came to pass when he began to reign, as soon as he sat on his throne, that he smote all the house of Baasha and left him not a single man child, neither of his kinfolks nor of his friends. Now, who did that? God did. He brought up these men and used them as instruments of his wrath. As we turn just a little bit further over into the Kings, in 1 Kings chapter 22, we're getting to the point on which we will close our study this evening, but in 1 Kings chapter 22, verses 19 through the end of this chapter, we see a number of events that occur that bring about the destruction of the northern kingdom. For example, in verse 35, it says, and the battle increased that day, and the king was stayed up in his chariots against the Syrians, and died at even, and blood ran out of the wound into the bottom of his chariot, and there went a cry throughout the host about the going down of the sun, saying, every man to his city, and every man to his country. And as we read on, we read about old King Ahab, how that he was killed, and how that the dogs licked the blood, just exactly like God had said. God said, I'm going to do this. But as we continue reading in the Kings, jumping way ahead to 2 Kings chapter 17, passing beyond a number of kings, in 2 Kings chapter 17, we read during the reign of King Hoshea, king of Israel. He reigned in Samaria 9 years, it tells us. In verse 2, he did that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah, yet not as the kings of Israel that were before him. Against him came up Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, and Hoshea became his servant and brought him tribute. And the king of Assyria found conspiracy in Hoshea, for he had sent messengers to So, king of Egypt, and offered no tribute to the king of Assyria, for he had done, or as he had done year by year. Therefore, the king of Assyria shut him up and bound him in prison. Then the king of Assyria came up throughout all the land and went up to Samaria and besieged it 3 years. years. And you read the rest of this chapter and you see how that the northern kingdom with its capital, Samaria, fell. Now I want to call your attention to the parallel text in 1 Chronicles chapter 5, where it tells us, "And the God of Israel stirred up the spirit of Pul, king of Assyria, and the spirit of Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria. And he carried them away, even the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh, and brought them into Halah and Habor and Hara and to the river of Gozan unto this day." Who did this? Who raised up the Assyrians to conquer these people? Well, God did. Now, wasn't that just exactly what Moses told them would happen back over in Deuteronomy chapter 4? Now, we don't know the history in Deuteronomy chapter 4. But now on this end, looking back, we see the history and God on every page of it. How can you explain that any other way? God said, "I'm going to do this." Hundreds of years pass, and every detail came to pass just exactly as God said. Now we're not talking simply about God knowing something was going to occur, but God said, "I will do this. I'm going to do it." And He did. And beloved, sometimes when I talk about these kind of things, it's interesting to me, not just interesting, but somewhat exciting, because it validates the inspiration of the Scriptures. When you consider that we have over 40 different men from all kinds of different backgrounds over a period of about 1,500 years, and they're writing a consistent revelation or a consistent plan or scheme of God to save man. Now, they're recording all these events of history. Why is that there? Somebody reads that and says, "Well, you know, I don't like to read from Old Testament history because I find it boring. I can't pronounce the names. I'll give you one up. I can't pronounce most of them either. But I still find it just absolutely fascinating to study, because it tells us of the God that we serve, the God to whom we pray. It tells us what He has done and what He is capable of doing. Providence. Interesting study, isn't it? To talk about God and His dealing with the affairs of man. You've listened patiently to our study. We'll stop there and pick up at this point in our next study. But perhaps I'm talking to someone who would desire to obey the gospel tonight. Maybe you're impressed with all that God has done for you, and you believe that Jesus is, in fact, the Christ, the Son of God. The evidence is so overwhelming, how can it be denied? And it be your desire tonight to repent of your sins, confess your faith, which be baptized into Christ tonight, to enjoy the forgiveness of your sins and the right relationship with the great God whom we serve. Maybe you've done that, and the life you're living now is a mess, and you know it better than anybody. Why not fix that? Repent of it. Confess it before God, and call upon these good folks to pray for you, that you might be right with the Lord. Can you think of anything more important that you could do? If you be subject to the Lord's invitation, make that known while we stand together and while we sing.